You are listening to the podcast of Providence Church in Austin, Texas. We hope this message raises your affections for Jesus and helps you live out the gospel in everyday life.
We are kind of on the front end of a preaching series on discipleship. And one of the things we said last week was that following Jesus requires commitment. And like in marriage, where you make an initial commitment, in discipleship, there's a moment where you drop everything and you follow Jesus. And you spend the rest of your life, you know, affirming that commitment and living out of that and growing in the context of that relationship. And it is the binding nature of the relationship that we have with God through Christ that God uses to focus our hearts on the priorities of His kingdom and to shape our character so that we become the kind of people who actually live out the things that Jesus teaches us to do. Following Jesus requires commitment. Now, one of the things I said was that one of the ways that God shapes us in this context is He often leads His people into very difficult, trying circumstances. You have relationships that are really trying. You have obstacles that are very challenging. You have circumstances in your life that are very hard, and God is using those things to form your character. I was talking with a friend who was in town a couple of weeks ago, and we were talking about just various trials in our lives, and he said, "Hey, Will, every life has a crucible. You know, a crucible is, it's basically a bowl that holds stuff that can withstand more heat than anything else in the bowl, and you can apply various degrees of heat to the stuff, and so that you can burn some stuff away, and you can keep other stuff." And that's what God is doing, is God applies heat to our lives to burn things away that hinder us in following Jesus, and to refine things in us that He wants to keep. Every life has a crucible. And in this passage in Luke that Lisa read, we're going to see four crucibles, four situations where there is desperate, it's a desperate situation, where the people are helpless, and where there's a demonstration of God's power in the desperate situation for the helpless people. So you have the disciples in a boat, and their life is threatened, and you have a man possessed by demons who's been cast out of the city. You have a woman who has been had a discharge of blood for 12 years. And you have a synagogue ruler whose 12-year-old daughter is about to die. Four desperate situations, helpless people, and four instances in which Jesus demonstrates His power toward them. Now, as you read this part of Luke, you see what Luke is trying to do. He's setting forth the evidence that this Jesus is the Son of God. He has unmatchable power. But at the same time, Luke is also teaching us something about the nature of faith and that following Jesus requires faith. I cannot overstate the centrality of faith for the Christian life and following Jesus. It's so important. Yet, it is a very misunderstood concept by advocates and critics alike. As I interact with people who have questions about Christianity and the Bible, skeptical questions, one of the things they often say is this. They say, "It seems to me Christians just have faith in faith." Which is not the biblical concept of faith at all. But I understand why they say that, because Christians say stuff like that. Let's just take the stuff in Luke 8. This is the kind of crazy stuff that people find hard to believe, as you can imagine. You have altering nature. You have, like, demon possession and casting demons out. You have instant healing, raising people from the dead. Come on, man. I mean, these are just stories to teach lessons, right? You can't actually be saying this stuff happened, can you? And when Christians get questions like that, that's when they say things like, "Oh, well, that's where faith comes in. You know, you just have to believe." Well, if you've asked those questions, you know that's not a very satisfying answer. Isn't that your point? Right. I don't believe because this stuff is crazy. Right? Christians have a way or tend to hide behind faith as a way to avoid tough questions. And when they do that, they only further the perception that Christian faith is something like blind faith. That faith is, you know, believing something to be true in spite of all of the contrary evidence. Well, that is not the nature of Christian faith. Yet that objection is out there. If you look at the Bible, in the Bible there's a very strong relationship between reason and knowledge and faith. And so to address some of these concerns, here's what I want to do. I just want to establish a framework for those of you who have these questions and maybe those of you who don't know how to answer these questions for the nature of Christian faith, and I think it'll serve us well in this text. The first thing that you have to consider is that everyone has faith. Everybody has faith in something. To say you don't have faith is itself a position of faith. All right. So let's just take the stuff in Luke 8. To say that the events of Luke 8 didn't happen is a position of faith. Right? You're just saying, from the evidence that I can gain, my faith statement is that the events in Luke 8 didn't happen. The deal is you can't empirically prove that. That's not a statement that everyone universally accepts. In fact, there's a lot of evidence that what Luke records in this document is very reliable and that these events did actually happen. And so at the very least, all we can say is that there's evidence on both sides of the question about whether or not this stuff in Luke 8 really happened. And so here's the question I'm getting to. If there's just evidence on both sides, then is believing the evidence for these things any more a leap of faith than believing the evidence against them? Tim Keller maybe puts it better than I do. He says, your doubt in Christian belief A, you hold that doubt because you also hold an unprovable belief B. And so in that way, every doubt is itself an alternative set of belief. It's based on a leap of faith. I'll try to put it this way. If we just take miracles, because that's what's going on in the text, if you're to say miracles can't exist, you're also implying that there can't be a God who does miracles. That's a statement of faith. It's a position of faith. Every doubt is an alternative belief that is also requires a leap of faith. Now, none of that means Christianity is necessarily true. All I'm trying to say is that everyone has faith. There is no such thing as pure doubt. That is a position of faith. And that gives us a groundwork for establishing the nature of Christian faith. And here's how I'm going to put it to you. The nature of Christian faith has to do with revelation versus something like speculation. Okay, so you just have to follow me here and then we'll get to the stories. If there's a God, if there's an eternal being who exists above us, beyond us, outside of us, as a God would, and we were just to, you know, talk about what he's like, we'd be speculating. Because I don't know, he's beyond us, and there's no way I could possibly gather all of the evidence that's available in the whole world throughout all of time to have certainty about anything, much less this God. And so if I were to say, I think God is like this, and he does these kinds of things, you could say, oh, that's interesting. Well, I think God's like this, and he does these kinds of things. And we could just go in circles, but we couldn't disagree with each other conclusively because both of us are absolutely uncertain because we're just speculating what God might be like. Okay, that's speculation. Revelation is different than that because if God revealed to us something about himself, in other words, if he condescended to us and told us something about himself, then we're not speculating anymore. Something's been revealed to us. And now I have true knowledge. Now I have a sense of certainty about what is true, not because I figured it out, because I have all of the evidence, but because God himself has said something about himself. And so the position of Christian faith is one of dependent certainty. I'm certain because I'm dependent upon this revelation from God. And that's different than speculation. When faith and knowledge begin with me as the starting point and what I can know in my limited capacity, then it is definite uncertainty. I absolutely cannot know everything there is to know, and therefore I can't be certain about anything. And so Christians are certain, but it's not an arrogant certainty. It's a humble certainty because it's not because I figured it out. It's because I'm trusting in what God has revealed to me, and that's the nature of Christian faith. That's the whole point of a book like the Gospel of Luke. Luke is saying, listen, I have carefully gathered the evidence from the life and teachings of Jesus, and I have put it together here for you so you can see that God has revealed himself in the person of Jesus. What we hear from this Jesus are the words of God. What we see in this Jesus are the ways of God. And if that's true, then things like nature miracles, healings, even demons, is not so crazy. In fact, it might be exactly what you would expect if God came to earth. That's how he would act. This is important because I'm going to present to you a definition of faith from the text in Luke 8 that has its grounding in the framework of Revelation. This definition is not faith in faith. It is not blind faith. It's faith in God who has revealed himself to us in the person of Jesus. All right, so here it is. Faith is trusting in Jesus' word and yielding to his ways. All right, faith in Jesus is trusting his word and yielding to his ways. All right, let's hop in the boat with the disciples for a moment. If you haven't been on the Sea of Galilee, neither have I. But let me tell you, it's not a sea, it's a lake. It's like 8 miles by 13 miles. It sits 700 feet below sea level, and it's surrounded by these mountains. And so as the wind comes over the mountains, it can kick up quite a storm. That wouldn't be news to the disciples. These are seasoned fishermen who know this lake well. But in this instance, a storm has come upon them like they have never seen. They don't know how to navigate this storm. And it's night. It would be hard to anticipate. The waves are crashing into the boat faster than they can bail the water out. I mean, they're going to sink. And meanwhile, Jesus is asleep. He's taking a nap. That's his way. So the disciples, you can imagine how they would feel, right? Have you ever been doing a lot of work while the people are slacking off? It's frustrating, right? So eventually they turn to Jesus, and they don't wake him up gently, but like panicking, saying, "Master, Master, we're perishing. Grab a bucket, do something. Get up." And Jesus gets up, and he turns and rebukes the wind and the waves. The wind stops, and that's impressive enough, but then the water calms immediately. Right? If you stop the wind, it would still take a while for water to stop, but not now. When Jesus rebukes it, it all comes to a calm. And then he turns to the disciples and he rebukes them. "Where is your faith?" In other words, you should know better by now. We've been together long enough. Well, the disciples were afraid before for their lives, but now they're really afraid. And they ask this question, "Oh man, who is this? That he commands the wind and the waves and they obey him." This is serious business, and they know it because they're familiar with the scriptures. The scriptures speak of God as the only one who can calm the raging sea. And there's a number of passages about this. I ran across this one this week. And this is the psalmist speaking about a past event, but the parallels to this event are pretty great. This is in Psalm 107, verse 23. He says, "Some went down to the sea in ships, doing business on the great waters. They saw the deeds of the Lord, his wondrous works in the deep. For he commanded and raised the stormy wind, which lifted up the waves of the sea. They mounted up to heaven. They went down to the depths. Their courage melted away in their evil plight. They reeled and staggered like drunken men at their wits' end. They cried to the Lord in their trouble, and he delivered them from their distress. He made the storm be still, and the waves of the sea were hushed." This is the God of Israel, who the psalmist speaks about, and the disciples know that, and so now they're wondering, could this be God? And there's an interesting commentary here, because even in the face of such great power, Luke shows us that faith is not easy. Many people encountered Jesus' power, but still struggled to believe, to make sense of it all. So they're beginning to wonder, but Jesus is saying, look, you should have known by now. At the beginning of the story, Jesus said, "Let's go across to the other side." And what he's telling them is, you should know that I do what I say. There's plenty of evidence to conclude that if I say, "Let's go to the other side," that you're not going to perish on the way, that we're going to, in fact, get to the other side. Now, you may say, okay, fine, maybe they just didn't hear. That's what my kids always say when they disobey. "I didn't hear you." All right, well, that just proves the point even further. I mean, if I know that someone has great authority and great power in what they say, then doesn't faith move me to hang on their every word? Wouldn't I do that with a deep belief that I must know what this man says? So not listening doesn't get them off the hook. You hear that, Ethan? Doesn't get you off the hook. It only proves more their lack of faith, because it didn't move them to hang on his every word. Now, I don't know what that says about us. If they should have known by then, how much more should we know by now? Let me tell you something that perplexes me as I talk with people about stuff that's going on in their lives. Life is moving so fast, and there are so many things that we are deciding every day. How we're going to raise our kids, how we're going to spend our money, how we're going to decide what gets to fill our minds, how we're going to interact with people, and on and on and on. There are important decisions that we're making all of the time. Why would we try to navigate these waters without knowing what God says? It doesn't make any sense to me. Yet, that is the commentary on many of our lives. We talk a lot here about firsthand knowledge of Jesus. Secondhand knowledge of Jesus, or secondhand faith, would be to know what other people say about Jesus. It would be to sort of know what your parents said about Jesus. It would be to take your cues for spiritual life from people who take their cues from Jesus. Secondhand faith, the thing about it is it passes for a while, but it burns away in the crucible. It can't handle it. Firsthand faith is different. Firsthand faith means that I am learning from Jesus personally. I read the Bible to gain intimate knowledge of what he says and what he does. I talk to him so that I might know how to apply his truth to the specific situations of my life. I'm learning to trust him in situations that I don't understand. I'm experiencing what it means to be empowered by him so that I might live a life that's beyond my own means. That's firsthand faith. Firsthand faith is not the absence of fear and doubt. Firsthand faith is confidence in Jesus in the midst of fear and doubt, because I'm with him personally. Do you have firsthand faith? Following Jesus is about firsthand faith. All right, so faith in Jesus means trusting his word. Secondly, it means yielding to his way. From our perspective, the disciples' reaction is makes a lot of sense. I mean, their life's in danger. Jesus is sleeping. What good does it do to have God on your side if he's asleep, right? And so they question him. Do you not see? Do you not care? Now, our natural reaction in times of crisis, when we're getting squeezed, is to take control. We want control. And we do this by putting ourselves in the driver's seat, by putting ourselves in the position of knowing what's best. Now, I want to be careful here. I'm not saying that faith is suppressing your fears or your doubts or your hard questions. In fact, the scripture is full of people who are pretty brutally honest with God about what's going on in their life. I'll read you one example in Psalm 13. Now, this is a great psalm of lament. And the psalmist often cry out to God in this "do you not care, do you not see" language. Let me read the first few verses of this for you. The psalmist says, "How long, O Lord, will you forget me forever? How long will you hide your face from me? How long must I take counsel in my soul and have sorrow in my heart all the day? How long shall my enemy be exalted over me? Consider and answer, O Lord, my God. Light up my eyes, lest I sleep the sleep of death. Lest my enemy say, I have prevailed over him. Lest my foes rejoice because I'm shaken." Okay, this is not a man who's suppressing his feelings. This is a man who brings hard questions to God. If you don't have moments of fear and doubt in your life, if you don't have hard questions for God, then you're either naive or just dishonest. Because life is hard. The difference is we cross the line when we begin to call God into question. His character, whether or not he cares for us. Look how the psalmist ends. He says, "But I have trusted in your steadfast love. My heart shall rejoice in your salvation. I'll sing to the Lord because he's dealt bountifully with me." It's like all this stuff is happening. I don't understand, but I submit to God's ways. Sometimes when we say, "Do you not care?" I think what we really are saying is, if you cared, God, you would have done something by now. If you cared, God, then you wouldn't let this happen. If you loved me, then you would have shown love to me in the way that I want to be loved by now. See, we cross the line when we call God into question for not acting according to our will, as opposed to submitting to his will. Tim Keller says, if you believe in a God big enough to stop the storms in your life, then you have to believe in a God big enough to stop them in the way he wants to. And beyond that, you have to believe in a God big enough not to stop the storm at all, if he has good reason. Following Jesus means yielding to his ways, even when I don't understand. We never totally understand. If we did, we'd have total knowledge, and we wouldn't need faith at all. We wouldn't need God. We'd be God. And that's really what lies at the bottom of our desire for control, is we want to be our own God. And that's just as old as sin. Satan wanted to be God. He deceived Adam and Eve so they could be like God. And we want to be our own God. We want to know everything. We want to be in control. Faith is a choice to worship God above myself as ultimate reality and the true source of knowledge. God rarely does things in ways that make sense to us or that we understand. And so he stretches us, he stretches our faith in the way that he deals with us. And so what I want to do with the rest of our time is just walk through these other three stories very briefly and consider God's way in these stories and the implications of that for our faith. So when they get across the sea, as Jesus said they would, they come to the shore. And now there has been a conflict in this town between the people of this town and this man who is violently possessed by demons. They had tried to chain him down and subdue him, but he was out of control. He was untamable. And so they exiled him outside of the city. And so when Jesus and his disciples get on the shore, this is the man that's before him. And we get introduced into a deeper level of conflict. It's not merely the city versus this man. It is Jesus versus the demons who possess this man. And it's not much of a match, really. And from the outset, the demons say, they know they have no choice. They have no chance. They know that Jesus is not going to let them inhabit a human soul any longer. And so they beg of him to let them go into this herd of pigs. And so Jesus does. He lets them go into this herd of pigs, and they are drowned in the sea. Now, I know that's absolutely crazy stuff. And there's lots of questions about the pigs, and if you want to talk about that, we can over dinner, perhaps. But if you think that's crazy, imagine the herdsmen who are sitting there watching their herd of pigs rush down this embankment and drown in the lake. This is the craziest, freakiest thing they've ever seen. They have no idea what to make of it. So they just run back into town and they tell the people, you're not going to believe what just happened out here. You got to come see. So they come out. Now, as the townspeople come out, they start to investigate. Okay, there's that guy. That was the crazy man. Okay, he's sitting there in his clothes, right mind. That's crazy. Okay, that's that guy. Now, okay, there's this guy, Jesus. That's the one. Yes. Okay, he's the one that subdued that man and put him in his right mind. And you can imagine the thought process. Well, if we couldn't control him, what makes us think we can control him? Maybe we should be more afraid of this man than that man. I mean, he did kill our pigs. They're threatened by the thought, by the unknown, of what Jesus might do next. The point here is Jesus' way in this situation cost them. That was a lot of money in those pigs. And some of you suspect that following Jesus will cost you something. Image, money, a relationship. Who knows what this guy will do next? Who knows what it will cost you? Well, I'll tell you what it'll cost you, because Jesus says it costs you everything, your whole life. Faith in Jesus is believing that losing everything is worth it if you get Jesus. The people in this town are freaked out and they're afraid, and they actually ask him to leave. Can you imagine having God in your midst and saying, no, we're good? Well, I can imagine it. People do it all the time. If you want God to leave you alone so you can have your life, he will do that. But in the end, you lose your life. The only way you get life is to lose everything and follow him. We get to the next scene. We're back in Jewish territory. And Jesus is approached by a local ruler of a synagogue. And so this guy has humbled himself greatly to come to Jesus because he's desperate. He's got a 12-year-old girl who's really sick and about to die. And nothing will make you more desperate than sick kids. And so this man comes to Jesus and he begs of him to come to his house and to lay his hands on his daughter so that she might be healed. And Jesus agrees to go with him. But on the way, there's a great crowd following them. And in the crowd is a woman who is also desperate. She's had a discharge of blood for 12 years, which is certainly a physical problem. But in that culture, that would make her unclean. And so there was also social embarrassment, and she is religiously unclean. She can't participate in the life of that community. She's an outcast and an exile. She's desperate. She's spent everything she's had. She's gone to every doctor imaginable, which Luke doesn't mention, which is funny because Luke's a doctor, but the other writers mention it. And none of them could do anything for her. And so she's convinced herself that if I could just touch this man, just the clothes that he's wearing, maybe then, maybe I could be healed. It's kind of it's faith, but it's kind of a quasi-magical, superstitious kind of faith. But it's all she's got. So she pries her way through this crowd, and she manages to just touch the edge of his garment. And when she does, immediately she feels in her body that she's been healed. It worked. She's got her life back. And so she just kind of slips back into the crowd. She doesn't want to make a scene. But as soon as Jesus knows. And he stops, and the whole parade stops, and Jesus turns, and he says, "Hey, who touched me? Right now, just now, who touched my clothes?" And it's kind of an odd question because there's so much commotion, and Peter's like, "What do you mean, who touched your clothes? I mean, look at all the people." But Jesus knows what just happened. And the woman knows what just happened. And Jesus just leaves this question hanging in the air, and there's just silence. And he's looking around. Now, can you imagine if you're this woman? Like, the adrenaline pumping through your body in this moment. She didn't want to make a scene. She just wanted like a touch-and-go miracle. Get in, get healed, get out, get on with life. I don't want to cause any commotion here. But it wouldn't be that easy. Jesus said, "Who touched me?" And so knowing that she probably wasn't going to be able to escape this, she comes forth in her fear and her trembling. I mean, you know, she's thinking, "What does he want with me? Wait, what can I possibly bring to the table here?" So she comes and she tells the whole truth about what had happened to her. And Jesus said, "It is your faith that made you well." This isn't magic. This isn't superstition. This is real power of God. And I want you to know that. It's your faith that made you well. And then he says, "Go in peace." And this isn't just a subjective feel good. This is speaks of her status with God. He says, it's not just that you're healed physically, it's that you have peace with God. Whole life restoration. For some of you, it would be the worst thing imaginable to be drug out into a crowd and have your deepest secret exposed. For some, all of you, to have your deepest secret exposed like that. I mean, just great embarrassment. But I think you have to consider, what if being in the presence of Jesus involves being in the presence of others? What if you can't do Christianity on your own? Can you yield to God when his way of bringing power into your life involves more than you bargained for? You see, faith is the key to changing your situation, but Jesus is not interested in emergency action only. He insists upon building relationship with us. Jesus calls her into this not to embarrass her, but to restore her, to give her whole life back to her. And some of you are superstitious in your faith. You make deals with God. You only pray in times of crisis. You treat God impersonally like he's a genie. And we all do that at times. But God came into our world as a man to deal with us personally. He's interested in relationship with us. And faith is opening yourself up to relationship with God that transforms your entire life. It's not rubbing the genie bottle just to get what you want. Well, as nervous as the woman may have been, can you imagine Jairus at this point? The synagogue ruler? Because they were headed to his house to heal his daughter who's dying. But Jesus stops. And I can only imagine what Jairus is thinking, like, wait, this is all backwards. You don't stop to treat the woman with a chronic illness and overlook the girl with the acute illness. That's malpractice. You can't do that. Something is not right here. She's had this for 12 years. Like, a few more hours is not going to hurt anybody. Let's get to the girl first, and then we'll come back to her. And sure enough, his worst fears are realized, because even while Jesus is still speaking with the woman, some people come from Jairus' house with the news. "Your daughter's dead. She's dead. Like, don't bother the teacher anymore. It's too late." And when Jesus hears the news, he turns to Jairus and he looks him right in the eye and he says, "Hey, do not fear, just believe." Now, I don't know what Jairus is thinking exactly in this moment. I do know what I would be thinking. What? What do you mean, believe? How can I just believe now? I did believe. I came out and got you. I was believing we were going back to my house, and you stopped. You committed malpractice. This is your fault. How can you ask me to believe in something that I now know is impossible? Apparently, in Jairus, there was some strand of belief, some hope, because they continue. And they get to his house, and when they get there, the mourning and the grieving has already begun, because she's dead. But Jesus says, no, she's not dead, she's just asleep. And everybody just laughs at him, because they know. And Jesus invites the family and a couple of disciples into the girl's room, and he says to her what a parent would say to their child. He says, "Little girl, it's time to get up. And she does. She gets up, and she begins moving around, and the people are amazed at what they've seen. Now, an obvious principle about faith in this story is that God's timing is not always ours, and you've experienced that, and that he is not subservient to us and what makes sense to us. Faith requires patience. It may be that God's taking his time for that very reason, to grow your patience. But something else that comes out in this story and comes out in a lot of the Gospels is the idea that people are amazed. And I want you to know that's different than having faith. Amazement and faith are not the same thing. You can be amazed at God, at what things that he's done. You can admire people of God. You can hear stories of things God has done. You can get goosebumps all up and down your neck. And that's not the same thing as faith. It's not bad, but it's not the same as personally appropriating the power of God in your day-to-day life. Amazement is kind of secondhand stuff. That's not the same as faith, firsthand faith. And that's where these stories lead us. These stories lead us into personal, deep faith in Jesus. Because Jesus came and he said, "I came so that you might have life." That's his word to us. And his way of bringing us life is to die on a cross. And so the movement of these stories points us to the cross, because that is the ultimate article of the Christian faith, that Jesus came to bring life by dying on a cross. And when we look at the cross, we still don't understand why God does everything in the way that he does, but we know that it's not because he doesn't love us. We know that it's not because he's detached from our situation or our condition. When we look at the cross and we see that Jesus went to it on our behalf, we have a deep consolation and a deep strength that he's truly with us. And that whatever we're facing, he's already overcome. These stories point us to the cross. So that when we look at the disciples in the boat and we see Jesus slumped over there, we're mindful of he's not just slumped over in a boat, but he is exhausted, slumped over on the cross. And it is not he who has fallen asleep on us, but it is we who have fallen asleep on him. In the eve to going to the cross, you know that scene in the garden where he's praying and he asks the disciples just to stand watch and pray, and they fall asleep three times. Here's Jesus being cast into the ultimate storm of God's wrath against sin, and they are falling asleep on him. And he endures that storm alone on our behalf, though we fail him. And of course, 3 days later, the waters are calm and the tomb is empty. He triumphs through that storm on our behalf. And it's not just Jesus who is exiled outside of the city. I mean, not just the demonic man exiled outside of the city. It's Jesus who has been cast out of the city onto the cross. It is Jesus who is yelling like a madman as he is beaten and torn apart on the cross. It is him that nobody wants anything to do with. But this is his way. This is how he's going to defeat Satan and sin and death once for all. And when we look at what it cost him, we know he loves us. And we're not concerned anymore about what it might cost us. And when we see the woman who is unclean touching Jesus. Now, in that culture, if an unclean person touched a clean person, they would become unclean, but that's not what happens with Jesus. The unclean touches the clean, and she becomes clean. And that's the gospel. We're all unclean. Nobody came in here clean today. But Jesus is the clean one. He is the perfectly righteous one who lived a righteous life on our behalf. And when he touches us, we become clean. We get his righteousness. And when we see Jesus raise the little girl from the dead, we see that what we think is impossible is quite possible with God. He raises from the dead. He has power even over death, and that's how we get life. When we look at the cross, we're meant to see that this whole life is a great storm. When you consider the world as God made it and the life that we were intended for and how it has been corrupted and stained by sin, the whole life, this whole world is a great storm. We're in a desperate situation. We are helpless people. And the cross of Christ is God's ultimate, once-for-all demonstration of his power toward us in our desperate situation. Paul says in Romans 5 that for while we were helpless, at the right time, Jesus died for the ungodly. That's us. Let me pray for us.
Thanks for listening to the podcast of Providence Church. For more resources and info, visit us online at www.providenceaustin.com.